You're listening to a podcast by the Perennial Leader Project. To learn more, visit perennial.substack.com. Greetings, friends, and welcome to another episode of In Search of Wisdom. I'm glad to be back after a short break and excited to share this episode with you. Today, my guest is Professor Jay Garfield, author of Losing Ourselves, Learning to Live Without a Self. Jay Garfield is the Doris Silbert Professor in the Humanities and Professor of Philosophy, Logic, and Buddhist Studies at Smith College. He is also a visiting professor of Buddhist philosophy at Harvard Divinity School. Professor Garfield is the author of multiple books, including Buddhist Philosophy, Engaging Buddhism, Buddhist Ethics, to name a few. In today's episode, expect to learn what it means to lose ourselves, the difference between conventional and ultimate truths, why losing ourselves connects with an ethical life, and much more. All right, without any further delay, I bring you the wise and gracious Professor Jay Garfield. All right, well, beautiful. Jay, welcome to In Search of Wisdom.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I was just saying, it's a real pleasure on my end. I've really enjoyed your book, which is going to be the topic of the conversation, Losing Ourselves, Learning to Live Without a Self. I think I've listened to maybe just about every podcast you've done probably over the last couple of years. So I'm really excited to have you on In Search of Wisdom to chat about it. But before we get into it, would you mind sharing how you initially found an interest in philosophy?
Well, that's a somewhat embarrassing story, if maybe a bit amusing. So I'm old enough to remember paper catalogs in college, and that's important. And when I went to college, I was young enough to be really stupid. So I went to college knowing what I wanted to study, and that was psychology. And the college I went to had this rule, which I thought was really stupid. That was that in your first semester, you couldn't take all of your classes in the same department. So I chose four psychology classes. Then I had to choose a fifth class. And I just looked through that catalog and I couldn't find anything that looked interesting. You know, it wasn't psychology. I didn't want to do it. Like I say, this is embarrassing. I was stupid. So I did what a whole lot of people of my generation did in circumstances like that. I closed my eyes. I opened the catalog and said, whatever course my finger lands on that fits my schedule, I'm going to take. And it was a philosophy course. It was called Philosophy and Values. I looked at the description and it looked so stupid. But I thought, well, I told myself I would do this, and hey, maybe during the ad drop period, I can drop it and pick up a psych class and nobody will notice. So I went to that class and it was actually pretty cool. It was pretty interesting. And after a couple of weeks, we started reading Hume and I fell in love and said, gosh, you know, we were reading Hume, in fact, on personal identity. And I read that section of the treatise and I thought, wow, philosophy can do this. I want to do philosophy. So I ended up majoring in psychology and philosophy. But that's how I got in.
Nice, nice. How about when you were a teenager, when you're thinking about, you know, majoring in psychology? Why psychology? What was going through your mind at that time, if you can remember?
Yeah, I can remember pretty clearly. I mean, it's partly psychology was kind of in the family. My mother's a psychologist. Mm. Now I've got two sons who are psychologists. So it's, you know, I'm the one who left. But I still work I still do experimental work in psychology, actually. I was just really interested then in the phenomenon of learning and trying to understand how it happens. And I was in particular really intrigued by the relationship between operant and classical conditioning, and wondering whether those were two different kinds of processes or the same process. And that was the question that I found really burning, was how do you find a theoretical framework that puts together the different kinds of learning theory? Mm. So it was pretty weird for a teenager, I guess. But I liked nothing more than thinking about learning theory.
Yeah, nice. Well, it's interesting. You used the word burning right there. I ask a similar question to everybody that comes on, and it's not that uncommon for something around like that teenage time frame to a burning, maybe a similar, you know, some sort of spark or insatiable curiosity that gets started or grabs a hold of someone. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think one way of putting it is, I mean, this is a question that's been in my mind for a very long time now, as you can probably tell in the book. It's that once you recognize that the mind isn't transparent to itself, that you can't just look inside and figure out how your mind works, the fact that we're self-alienated in that way provides this enormous challenge to anybody who thinks it's important to know who you are. And so psychology and that time learning theory, of course, now I'm gone a little past that, but psychology seemed to me like the route in once you give up on introspection.
Well, that's a great transition to maybe start with defining terms, and two that will likely come up in the conversation and obviously in your book is this idea of a self and person.
Yeah.
How do you briefly define and differentiate that? Obviously, this will be the topic of the entire conversation, but to get us started.
Sure. I think that's really important. And I don't pretend that everybody uses these terms in the same way. And in a lot of colloquial conversation, we use them completely interchangeably. And some philosophers use them one way, some use them another way. But I think that for the purposes of this kind of investigation, and this kind of conversation, it's really important to regiment our language so that we know what we're talking about and so that we can draw the distinctions that we need to draw without getting them all muddled and confused. So I use the word self to refer to that thing that's often called in classical Greek psuche or in Sanskrit atman. And that's the thing that I think we naively take ourselves to be, a kind of persistent soul, something that's constant throughout our lives, something that's distinct from our body, from our mind, is the thing that has the body and the mind, the thing that we experience as the subject of our experience, that's never an object, as the agent who's doing things, but not something on which we act, that kind of thing behind the scenes. One of the best metaphors for that, I think, in Western philosophy is one that Wittgenstein uses in his book, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, when he says that we think of the self or the I, that is the letter I, like the I in the visual field. When we look out at the visual field, the I isn't in the field. It's the thing that's doing the seeing. And nothing that we see tells us it's being seen by an I. But we know we have this feeling there's something behind it that's doing the seeing. Similarly, when we experience our own body, when we experience our thoughts, when we experience objects in the external world, we have this sense that we are experiencing them, but not part of that ensemble that we're experiencing, that we're distinct as subject from our objects. That's what I use the word self for. And I argue that there is no such thing, that that's an illusion and a myth. The other term that I use, though, is person. And this is a term that the English philosopher John Locke introduced for exactly this purpose, and Hume uses it as well. And that refers to what we actually are. The word person comes from the Latin persona, which we still have in, for instance, dramatic personae in a play, and it means a character, a role in a play. It actually comes from the term that meant a mask, the kind of mask that actors wore when they were playing roles on the stage. But the person indicates our kind of constantly changing social roles. And that's what we really are. We're constantly changing, causally interdependent, collectively constituted ensemble actors. So to use an analogy that I use in the book, if you go to a performance of Hamlet, you don't see a Danish prince on the stage. You see an actor on the stage. But you're not going to see a play about an actor. You're going to see a play about a Danish prince. And you want to be able to see through that actor to see that Danish prince. That role is one that might have been played once by Sir Laurence Olivier and more recently by Benedict Cumberbatch, somebody else in your local repertory theater. That role remains the same through all of the changes. And it's the role that we take seriously. That's the persona. And so the book argues that we very often confuse persons with selves. And so we take ourselves as persons to in fact be something different, to be selves. That's a way of confusing the role with the actor.
Beautiful. And how about conventional and ultimate truth?
Okay. That's a set of distinctions or distinction that comes from classical Buddhist philosophy. And I bring that in to help illuminate this so that, you know, part of my philosophical method is to draw ideas, terminology, arguments from as many traditions as I can. And this book weaves together some thoughts that come to us from Indian and Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, from Japanese and Chinese Buddhist philosophy, but also from the history of Western philosophy. I see these as just part of a single human project. So that when we talk about the distinction between conventional and ultimate truth, conventional truth is the world as we ordinarily experience it. The world of human beings and dogs and cats and tables and chairs and money and theaters and all of the stuff that we find around us. When we talk about ultimate truth, we're talking about what might exist independently of or underlying all of this conventional reality. Now, people have got different views about that, about what's ultimately real. Some people think, oh, gee, minds aren't real, but bodies are. Some people think bodies aren't real, but minds are. Some people think that macroscopic objects aren't real, but atoms and subatomic particles are. Some people might think that human beings aren't real, but livers and hearts and kidneys are real, are ultimately real. So that distinction can be used in many ways. In the Madhyamaka or middle way tradition of Buddhist philosophy, which is the one on which I draw primarily in this book, the real secret is that the ultimate truth is that things are empty of having any essence or ultimate truth or any ultimate reality. And so one way to put that, as my colleague Mark Sideritz has put it so memorably, is that the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. There is no final way that things are. There's only ways we take things to be, ways that things show up for us, ways that things appear to us. So when we try to find something ultimately there behind the conventions, we just find more conventions.
And I've heard you talk about some examples between bees, dogs, and humans.
Yeah.
Which is really helpful. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Like most of us, I'm a dog lover. Not everybody.
Me too.
I like to think about dogs. And I also like bees. And dogs and bees are interesting to me. A lot of animals are interesting to me, but these make nice examples for present purposes because their sensory systems and hence the cognitive systems that are hooked up with those sensory systems are so very different from our own. We're very visual creatures, having been, you know, primates and being primates, and we've kind of evolved to experience the world primarily through our visual sense, and our auditory, olfactory, gustatory, tactile senses are kind of in the service of that. So if you look around your room right now, you sort of see objects, and they might feel a certain way, sound a certain way if you rap on them, smell a certain way if you haven't cleaned them recently or whatever. But you're fundamentally seeing visible objects that have those other kinds of capacity, those other kinds of properties. And a huge part of our brain is devoted to processing visual information. And a lot of the representation of objects depends upon those parts of our brain. Now, dogs are really different. They're olfactory first creatures. They live in a world of smells, and an enormous part of their brain is devoted to an olfactory bulb. So just as the largest part of our sensory apparatus is the occipital cortex, the largest part of the brain set of a dog's sensory apparatus is the olfactory bulb. And so quite literally, a dog's world is a world of volumes of constantly changing smell that happen to look in a particular way, sound a particular way. But the objects are volumes, literally evolving volumes of smell, which is very different from ours. It's very hard to even imagine that. And of course, dogs also see in a very different range of frequencies than we do, a much more restricted range. Bees are really different. Bees have got extremely complex eyes and lots of them. And they see in the ultraviolet and infrared range, as well as what we would think of as the visual spectrum. So, for instance, flowers that look just white to us might have lots of spots and stripes and things to bees. And bees are also, by the way, sensitive to electromagnetic fields. So they also perceive things aligned on the Earth's electromagnetic field in a way that we have no clue about. So I like to imagine being in an environment, whether it's a room or a garden or a forest, with me, a dog, and a bee, and think about our very different experiences of that. For me, it's a world of objects that are visible in terms of a fairly limited spectrum of the light, but they're primarily visual objects, and they look a particular way. For my dog, it's this world of volumes of changing smells that appear very, very differently. I can't smell the smells, and the dog can't see the sights that I'm seeing, and the objects are just defined differently. If it's a bee, then it's things that are seen in this incredibly complicated way with patterns of electromagnetic fields and completely different range of visible properties. So now here's the trick now, once we've got that out. You want to ask, and this does connect directly to your question about conventional versus ultimate. So we might say there's a world way the world appears to ordinary conventional people like me, a way the world appears to ordinary old dogs like my dog, a way that the world appears to ordinary little bees like the bee I'm imagining right now. But then if somebody were to say, yeah, it looks really different to all of those, but what does it really just look like? I mean, independently of who's looking at it, what does the world just look like in itself? What's the ultimate way the world is? The moment somebody asks that question, you recognize how moronic it is, right? You can talk about the way the world looks to a person. You can talk about the way the world looks to a dog, or appears to a dog. I think looks is a little bit prejudicing it in the wrong direction. You can talk about the way the world looks to a bee, but to ask about the way the world just plain looks doesn't make any sense. And that's a nice way of saying there is no ultimate way the world just is. There are just ways that it shows up for different kinds of beings.
Great. I love it. Before we get too far, I'd like to talk about two philosophers that you say influenced the book. Chandrakirti, I may have pronounced that incorrectly.
Chandrakirti, yeah.
A 7th century Indian philosopher, and then a figure you already mentioned, David Hume, 18th century Scottish philosopher. Could you briefly talk about these two and, you know, how they've, you know, influenced your thinking along the way?
Yeah. Of course, anybody's influenced by lots of people, and that's part of just who we are as human beings and certainly who we are as scholars and thinkers. But the two guys who I tend to orbit around a lot in the history of philosophy are Hume and Chandrakirti. There are others, too. I mean, there's a big club of people I turn to. But Hume and Chandrakirti are the big guys. Let me start with Chandrakirti. So as you said, he's a 7th century Indian philosopher in the Buddhist tradition. He lived from about the year 600 to the year 660. And he taught at Nalanda University, which at the time of his life was by far the largest university in the world. It's in present-day Bihar in eastern India. And Chandrakirti worked in this Madhyamaka or middle way school of Buddhist philosophy. And what I find fascinating about Chandrakirti is he's the philosopher in that tradition who thought more deeply and more carefully about the nature of conventional truth and about what makes conventional truth a truth, even if it's not ultimately true, than anybody else. So he's somebody who really asked, how do our conventions do this? How does language work? How does agreement between us work? How does ordinary practice in the marketplace or in the laboratory or in the seminar room work to constitute our reality? And I find Chandrakirti's insights into this, and in particular, his very deep insight that just because something isn't ultimately true doesn't mean it's not true. Just because something is not ultimately real doesn't mean that it's not real. To be real is for there to be a difference. This is Chandrakirti speaking. For there to be a difference between getting it right and getting it wrong about it. And there is a big difference between getting it right and getting it wrong about conventional entities. To be real or to be true is to be that there's a way to come to know something. And we have lots of ways of coming to know the world that we share. And so that connection of epistemology and thinking about getting it right and getting it wrong and how we do so, and the world that we live in, that Chandrakirti draws, I find extremely profound. So that's why I'm so interested in Chandrakirti. Hume is also the great philosopher of convention. And Hume is drawing, of course, well, not necessarily of course, but for those of us who study Hume, on the Greek Pyrrhonian skeptical tradition. So Hume is writing and thinking at a time when skepticism is being renewed. Sorry about that. When skepticism is being renewed in Europe. And Hume is fascinated by both phases of Greek skepticism. The first phase is the demonstration that there are no foundations for knowledge, that if you think that things ground out and there's something that is simply self-evident on which everything else is based, if you think that there's a fundamental way the world is as opposed to the way it appears, then you're out of your mind. And a lot of people have sort of stopped at that point and thought of skepticism as a purely negative position, that it just denies the possibility of knowledge or that it denies the reality of the world. But Hume saw the positive phase of skepticism that we see in the work of that great exponent of skepticism in the classical world, Sextus Empiricus. And Sextus emphasized the positive phase of skepticism as well, that once we recognize that there are no foundations, once we recognize that there's no simple way the world is independent of how we take it, there's still epistemic functions, knowledge of acquiring functions that guide our activity. Sextus called it the fourfold prescription. He was a doctor, so he thought in terms of prescriptions. He said, what do? We follow our perceptions. We follow the appearance, the way things appear to us. We follow our natural instincts and appetites. We follow the instructions of the arts, that is, the skills that we acquire as human beings. And we follow the customs of our country. And that's enough in daily life. Now, those customs include customs for doing science and for doing detailed analysis and for arguing and reasoning. And Sextus's insight was all of those things are fabulously useful. They give us the lives that we have. They make us human beings. They allow us to know our world, but they're just practices. And what they deliver are what practices deliver, not a practice-independent reality. Now, that view is very similar to Chandrakirti's view, that view of Hume's. And there's probably a common ancestry there. Because if we look at the history of philosophical thought in Greece and in India, and we remember that when Alexander the Great came to India, he brought philosophers with him. And in fact, the philosophers he brought with him were Pyrrho, after whom Pyrrhonian skepticism is named, and his student Timon. And the biographies of Pyrrho and Timon that we have from Diogenes Laertius report that they went to India and they debated with philosophers there, and then they came back saying certain things. And the things they came back saying are almost entirely quotations from Indian Madhyamaka Buddhist scriptures. So we've probably got a kind of confluence there of thinking. And we have to also remember that India and Greece were never really separated. There was an enormous amount of interaction through Persia and through the Silk Road. So all of these ideas that percolated as skepticism was developed in Greece and as the Madhyamaka school was developed in India are redolent in Chandrakirti and in Hume. And so it's not surprising that I like both of these guys, each of whom is really a philosopher of the conventional.
Nice. So interesting and pretty fascinating that that first philosophy class that you reluctantly signed up for touched on Hume. Such an interesting and beautiful thing.
It just shows us that most of what's important in our life happened by accident.
Yeah. So this podcast is primarily a philosophy podcast. We obviously touch on Eastern philosophy and Buddhism and things like that and some of these things, but there may be many listeners that are very new to some of this. How do you think about just being open to, you know, this idea that the self is an illusion, you know, or that it's a noble pursuit, if that's a thing, to, you know, work down this path of being a selfless person. I'm curious if skepticism, you know, just this idea of not knowing and humility, some sort of openness, you know, what comes up around that?
I think it's super important. As I said earlier, you know, why did I care so much about psychology? It's because at some point I realized that you can't just look inside and figure out how you work. We don't have a kind of manual to our own minds, and we're not transparent to ourselves. The longer you think about it, the more you think that you come to realize it's not just a matter of a lack of transparency, but it's the fact that we are subject to illusions of all kinds. So an example that I use throughout the book, and it's a pedantic example, but I use it only because it's so easy to draw on a blackboard, is the Mueller liar illusion. And so it's easy to describe as well as it is to draw, and anybody can do this. Just draw two lines parallel to one another of about the same length. And on one of them, draw arrowheads facing out, and on the other one, draw arrowheads facing in. And suddenly, the one with the arrowheads facing out looks longer than the one with the arrowheads facing in. And even though you yourself draw it or watch somebody draw it, and you know those two lines are the same length, you can't avoid seeing them as different in length once the arrowheads are gone. Now, we know that's a kind of artifact of the way that our visual system evolved to estimate the sizes of things using edges and things like that. And that for most of our experiences, the way our visual system works is just fine. And it delivers objects with boundaries the way it should and relative sizes the way it should. But then we also know that it can be tricked. It's subject to illusion. There are also, of course, familiar auditory illusions, many of which are studied by linguists because they're important to understanding how we process speech. And you can even have olfactory illusions, it turns out, all kinds of illusions. And what that means is that evolution did not design our nervous systems to be perfect detectors of the external world or the internal world or reality in general. Our nervous systems evolved to enable us to survive long enough to reproduce and to keep our kids alive long enough so that they reproduce. That's how natural selection works. It doesn't favor people who get it right. It favors people who breed successfully. And it turns out that you can create a successful breeder with fast and dirty algorithms that generally get it right and sometimes get it wrong. And so we find out that as ordinary evolving biological organisms, which is all we are, that we're subject to illusions. The moment you recognize that all of your external senses are subject to illusions, you have to wonder whether your introspective capacities are also subject to illusions. And the cool thing is, this only occurred to me for the first time when I was pretty well on in studying philosophy. And this came through attention to the work of Wilfred Sellers, who was one of my principal teachers. But then I realized when I hit Buddhist philosophy, it was thematized there long before. And it's the idea that we think when we just look inside, that our inner states, our feelings, our thoughts, and so forth, just appear to us as they are. Now, Freud started disabusing us of that a long time ago, right? That we're not transparent to ourselves. So that once you think that there are these cognitive illusions, you start wondering how deep it goes, right? And you recognize that a kind of profound skeptical abyss has to open up between us as observers of ourselves and us as the things that are being observed. And one of the things that we tend to simply take for granted is this idea that there's a self lying behind there. But as Chandrakirti pointed out, and as Hume pointed out, when you put pressure on that one, it starts crumbling pretty quick. And what you end up having to say about it becomes pretty incoherent. Just like saying, oh, these two lines I drew, they're the same length, but they're different lengths. You don't want to say that. And similarly, you don't want to say, yeah, there's my mental capacities and my physical capacities, but there's something else that's not physical and not mental behind them that owns them, right? Everything about me is constantly changing, except who I am. And the moment you start saying those things, you realize it's getting pretty screwy. So that suggests to me that the self is one of those cognitive illusions we've evolved to succumb to. Just like we've evolved to succumb to the visual illusion or the Mueller-Lyer illusion or the tactile rubber glove illusion. So it's thinking about that that really got me there. And it's very cool that that's an insight that emerges independently in 7th century India. And of course, then Hume points out the idea of the self as an illusion in 18th century Europe. And then it gets a little more scientific by 20th and 21st century European philosophy.
I'm curious if you think of any upside to the illusion of self. To be more specific, I have young kids and things like that, and there's certain things that maybe a young person isn't quite, I don't even know how to say it really, but maybe in the way of maybe the fear of death, which we'll probably talk about. I have another note for that, yeah. But it's not something you maybe suggest to a super young person of practicing memento mori or meditating on their mortality. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, are there any upsides to this illusion of a self?
I think that there's one obvious historical upside, and then there might be a few what I might call clinical upsides, but I think the downside is really big, and that we can get the upside without the downside. So here's the obvious one. It obviously had survival advantage, or we wouldn't have evolved for it. I think that it's a spandrel on interoception and proprioception. I've got no evidence for this, by the way. This is just a hunch. Obviously, proprioception and interoception, our ability to know where our body is, in what position it is, and what's going on inside of us, is really important to our survival. If you've got deficits in those things, you're in big trouble. And it may well be that the quick and dirty way that evolution gave us for kind of attaching those properties to something we could understand was the illusion of self. So it may have had a kind of selective advantage there. But I think its psychological disadvantages are dramatic. Now, again, you might have other psychological advantages. If there's somebody who feels absolutely helpless, you might say, look, you've actually got some agency. Let's talk about that, right? Mm-hmm. And try to build up their sense of ego in that way. But I think there are better ways. And you talked about it in terms of childbearing, and I raised children as well. So I do think about this issue, and I teach students. Here's one thing to really notice, because I spend a lot of time crossing cultures in my life. And a lot of my time is spent in Tibetan culture, which is a culture saturated by Buddhism, where people don't think in terms of self and think of the idea of a self as a really bad idea and don't raise their kids with that kind of self idea. And it leads to a lot of really big differences. I've studied some of these, my colleagues, Sean Nichols and Nina Strominger and I have done a lot of studies of these things. The cultural differences end up being really interesting. Think about it this way. A lot of Americans, in my experience, at least a lot of Americans I know, including my parents, think that it's really important to raise kids to be proud of themselves and to recognize their achievements and take pride in them, right? They even say things like, we want our kids to feel independent, to learn to stand on their own two feet, to be masters of their own lives. Things like, we all recognize those phrases. Now, I'm going to focus on a few of those phrases and see why I think they're actually counterproductive and irrational. When we ask people to be proud of their own achievements, what we're asking them to do is to take complete ownership of their agency as something that they've done all by themselves and just comes from themselves. Consider the alternative, which is the one that I hear in Tibetan cultures. Be grateful for your achievements. When you've achieved something, you win the race. You think, wow, I'm so fast. I'm so good. Think instead. My coach is so fabulous. My parents were so cool getting me to track practice. The people who designed my shoes were just absolutely brilliant. Start thinking about who made that possible, and you end up getting a more realistic view of where you are in the world. And I think gratitude is a much healthier attitude than pride. It's often one that lets you say, gee, what could I do to pay this back? Rather than, where's my reward? Which I think is really helpful. I always, tell my students, that's a great paper. You must have had a great first grade teacher. Your parents must have really raised you right. Think about those people now, because they're the people who are standing behind you when you wrote that. Because I think cultivating that attitude of gratitude is just so much healthier than that attitude of pride. Similarly, when somebody does something that annoys you and you think it's time to get really angry, right? Ask yourself instead, what are all of the causes and conditions that led them to do that? And how must they be feeling if they said or did that, right? What must be going on in their life? And then you flip, and instead of responding with anger, you respond with an attitude of care or sympathy. And that's a much healthier way to be. It's not just better for other people, it's better for you. It makes you more morally mature. It makes you more calm. It makes you more helpful. It makes you happier. And I think the self-illusion that says people do things all by themselves. So if somebody did something bad, it was their fault. If I did something good, I'm a fabulous hero, are really bad ideas. When people talk about learning to stand on your own two feet, just think about that for a minute. Does that mean that I've got to make the dirt that I'm standing on? Does that mean that I better have made the shoes that I'm standing in? Does that mean I better have raised all the food that I used so I can grow up enough and live long enough to stand? I mean, what exactly does that mean? That's a way of creating an illusion of individualism, and that is an illusion of self, instead of attending to the reality of interdependence. Again, my Tibetan parents I know don't use those words. They say things like, grow up to be a good member of society. Grow up to be a good family member, right? So they're thinking about context and interdependence rather than taking individuals out of context and thinking of them in terms of independence. And that comes from growing up in a culture where there's a constant drumbeat of get rid of that illusion of self. And as a consequence, people tend to be a little bit happier, a little bit less stressed, a little bit more generous, and fear death less. So I think there's just a lot of good things about that.
I love it. I'm thinking as you're talking about that, this standing on your own two feet and really, you know, believing that in some deep way, how anxiety inducing, you know, how much like pressure there is, behind that. And I love how
somebody's got your back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But I love how in this book, you say early on that it's a book about ethics. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when you hear people talk about the illusion of the self, it's not always directly connected with moral behavior. Could you say a bit more about that?
That's right. The discussion we've just been having is a nice bridge to that idea. I think of ethical cultivation as primarily cultivating our experience of ourselves and others as interdependent beings that share a world. It's one thing to see the world in what I like to call a kind of polar coordinate system, where I'm at the origin, I'm at the center, and everything else is seen in relation to me. There's my friends, there's my enemies, there's my family, there's the people to whom I'm not related. There's my students, and then somebody else's students. There's my country, there's other countries. There's America first, who's second, who's third, who's fourth, right? If my mom is first, who's second, who's third, who's fourth, right? Coming to see the world, see ethical cultivation as being shedding that view, right? Which is a kind of, I think, an innate view that comes from the view of self. Because when we start with that view of self, each of us is unique. I become the subject and everything else is object. And that puts me at the center and creates this kind of geography of the ethical domain that's fundamentally distorted and egocentric. So I see that the task of ethical cultivation is eroding that view and coming to see an ethical landscape in which there is no center and in which nobody has the subject position, in which we're all interdependent, interacting organisms, each of whom have the potential to be happy, the potential to be unhappy, each of whom has interests. When we see the way this works out in our own lives, and I mean this kind of collectively thinking about us kind of growing up in a broadly European culture, it has really pernicious, that is the self-view, has really pernicious ethical consequences. Here's one of them. Anybody who has studied microeconomics will know that economists define rationality as the disinterested pursuit of my own utility. So that the rational economic actor is somebody who tries to get as many toys and as many goods for him or herself without worrying about what other people are doing. Now, for a hypersocial great ape like us, that isn't rationality. That's suicide, right? If you try to lead your life rationally in that sense of rationality, then you've got to decide that like your partner's well-being doesn't matter unless it makes you happy. Your kid's well-being doesn't matter unless it happens to make you happy. That the culture you live in and your society doesn't matter unless it makes you happy. And I think we do raise people to think that way, to think in a hyper-competitive, individualistic way. And the paradox, of course, is that the more you go after your own individual utility at the expense of other people, the less happy and the less successful you are. Because as social beings, our happiness and our success always depends upon the happiness and success of others and living in a situation where everybody else is happy and successful. People who live in gated communities are not gating them because they're happy and secure. They're gating them because they're scared. And they're scared because they know they've got that wealth by competing with everybody else and they're afraid somebody's going to come get it, right? Mm. And so I think that when we look at the self illusion, it percolates ethically into egoism. And the idea that my own interest is all that counts. Whereas if we think of ourselves as persons, I mean, the analogies that I like to use there are, you know, members of a sports team. I mean, now it's March Madness, right? Members of a basketball team. Or I always think in terms of cricket or football, but you might also think in terms of actors in a play. If you would never imagine a really great player coming home and saying, the game was great. I played fabulously. Of course, we lost, but I played really well. That's not a good game, right? And somebody who simply always wants the ball and never passes is not somebody who makes their team a good team. Our success is success in collective venture. And that comes when we understand ourselves interdependently and give up viewing ourselves independently. That's why I mean it's ethical. So when we look at what happens when we cultivate the no-self view, we end up developing a better ability to be friendly, a better ability to care about others, a greater impartiality towards others, and a wonderful ability to find our happiness in the success of others. If the only being whose happiness means anything to you is you yourself, you've got a very small well of happiness to draw on. But if you're able to see everybody as like you, then you've got this enormous source of happiness to draw on. And it's just, it makes us better people and happier people to think in a no-self way. And that's why I say it's, in the end, ethical.
Beautiful. I'm always curious, and towards the end of these conversations, try to get as practical as we can. Being a person, showing up as a person, is it fair to say that this is not something that we can necessarily do 100% of the time?
I think it's hard. Mm-hmm. I think that we also underestimate the amount of time we actually do spend doing that, I think. And mm-hmm. very often we're in just relaxed, spontaneous interaction with people, we kind of leave our ego at the door and sort of shed that. But I think that it's culturally complicated for us because the culture that many of your listeners grow up in, this American or European culture, is a highly individualistic, highly self-centered culture. And so we're kind of educated to see ourselves as selves. And that's built on, I think, an innate tendency to do that because of this kind of illusion. And that's why ethical education and cultivation is both important and difficult. Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics says, how we raise our children makes a very great difference, or rather, all the difference. Mm-hmm. And he's reflecting on the importance of constant ethical education. Now, he doesn't share exactly the view that I have, but you know, he's got a pretty social view about who we are. Yeah. And I do think when we look, say, at Confucian culture, we see, again, the virtues that are cultivated very early are relational virtues, virtues like filiality, virtues like humane openness to others. Again, in the Buddhist context, we've got also an interdependent sensibility. And I think that that's something we do have to teach. And it's also something that each of us has to focus on. For my part, I think that, you know, when I catch myself thinking egoistically, when I catch myself in that self-illusion, that's when I kind of want to stop, pause, take two or three long, deep breaths and ask myself, how did I get here? What's the emotional response that led me to this rather than how I should be? Let's just walk this back a little bit. Hmm. And I do think that affect is very deeply related to this. We're most likely for that sense of self to come up when we've got strong emotions, when we're either very angry or very proud, very happy, depressed. Those are times when we sort of focus on and kind of fixate on that illusion. And I think those are the times we have to ask ourselves, how am I experiencing my existence? Does that make sense? Let me walk this back a little bit. And I think that by doing that, we can become more responsive, less reactive individuals. And that's a really good thing.
Would that be an example of the shedding that you were talking about? I'm thinking of the example that you brought up of the student that does very well on a, you know, paper, an exam. And yeah, you must have, well, it's wonderful. You must have had a great first grade teacher. And wow, it's wonderful that there's a university, that there's shelter, that there's air conditioning and a professor yeah. and students that probably helped you along the way by asking great questions and on this massive web.
Yeah.
But yet there's a desire to, like, an insecurity or some, you know, who knows, it could be so many things, but some sort of desire to want to, like, feel good or take more credit than is than is warranted towards whatever it may be.
Yeah. I try to help my students see past that. To be really happy and proud and satisfied with the work, and to be really, and to see that they themselves as persons are moving forward, but also to recognize that if they want to continue moving forward, they need the same kind of support that got them this far. And they also owe it to others to give that same kind of support. I think that they do better and they become happier when they recognize that. And it also helps break down feelings of isolation. And, you know, you make that phone call to your parents at that point and say, "Mom, Dad, thanks for making this possible. I just wrote a really good paper. I've got some really good insights. I just want to thank you for this." It's something that makes people happier than saying, "Wow, I did this all by myself." And as I say, I think gratitude is one of our most important emotions. It's not just an emotion that's good for the people to whom we're grateful. It makes us happier when we feel that way. And we can kind of recognize that we don't stand against the world. We're embraced by the world. And that sense of embrace can be extraordinarily rewarding. And it's one to which we don't often enough draw ours and each other's attention.
Yeah, it's paradoxical and beautiful. I love how you conclude the book. To accept that you have no self is not to reject your identity. It is to reclaim your humanity. I really, really love it. And I'm so grateful for your time today. If we could, to wrap it up, we ask most guests, when time permitted, this question about wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you define or think about wisdom in daily life, Jay?
Yeah, I think the way that I would define it, and I'm probably misdefining it, but this is how I think about it. It's the recognition that I only experience the world as it shows up for me, and that I experience that world as a member of a community, and that it's extraordinarily important for me to always ask, how is this same world showing up for other people?
Nice. Well, this has been great. And again, your book is Losing Ourselves. I highly recommend it. I'll link it in the show notes along with, your website, so it's easy to find for people. And I'm also going to link another episode that you did on the Wisdom Podcast, which I think this might be a nice introduction to. So that's easy to find as well. Is there anything we didn't touch on that maybe we should, or anything you'd like to mention to the listeners before we conclude?
Well, I think it's been a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. There's so much more we could always talk about, but I think what we've talked about is some important things. And I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Beautiful. Well, my pleasure. Professor Jay Garfield, thank you so much for coming on In Search of Wisdom.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the In Search of Wisdom podcast. I hope you found something useful for daily life. If so, I encourage you to put what you heard into practice. If you're interested in more tools for the art of living, consider subscribing to Perennial Meditations on Substack. By becoming a member, you'll help support the project, and gain access to our podcasts, meditations, and courses. Until next time, be wise and be well.